We have some technical issues here that I think our IT department, Elizabeth Brown, court clerk, has got that worked out so we can get these proceedings recorded here. And certainly a historic day. We want to make sure we get it recorded. So we want to welcome our two new colleagues to the bench. On my left here at the end, Justice Abby Silver. On my right, Justice Alyssa Kadish. So it's a pleasure to have both of them join the court. And, of course, Justice Lydia Stieglitz was re-elected as well in the last election, so we're glad to have her back for another full six-year term now. Okay, with that background, we'll go ahead and get started on today's hearing. So the first case I'll call is case number 71609, Share Development versus Desert Land Acquisition. We have on behalf Mr. Fetter on behalf of the appellants and Mr. Wall on behalf of the respondents. Mr. Fetter, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
That's my goal. Okay. I hope to. Okay. We'll see how well I do.
Well, we got a lot of questions here, so we'll give it a shot. So we'll just, but when you, why don't we have this, beep go off when you have 5 minutes remaining, because each side will have 15 minutes, and then you can reserve time, then decide how much you want to reserve. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll go ahead. And first of all, before we get started, I don't know if any of the justices have any preliminary questions you'd like to go into.
I do. Just before we get started, I just want to make sure I understand this. This is an appeal from a preliminary injunction.
It is.
And my understanding is there was a proceeding that postdated this, and there's a final judgment in that. And that was a permanent injunction, is that correct?
That would be correct.
So my question is, why isn't this merged and that makes this moot?
It's our position that when it comes with respect to the issue, the underlying issue of statutory interpretation is continuing into the permanent injunction. While we got the permanent injunction granted on the basis that it was determined to be a transaction that didn't even fall within the contours of the statute, it wasn't even something under 645B.340, so it wasn't even within the contours. And then Judge Gonzalez then stated that it was also commercially unreasonable and unfair and actually found bad faith. But she continued with the same basis as the denial of the preliminary injunction and why it was denied, because she made a determination that Desert Land Loan Acquisition had standing, that they can utilize the statute, notwithstanding the fact that they are related entity to the borrower, related entity to the guarantors, and that continued into the permanent injunction. So we believe that continued, not just in the permanent injunction, it continued throughout the case. So that statutory interpretation issue is something that continues with respect to the issues that underlie even the granting of the permanent injunction. We're here standing firm with respect to the permanent injunction. One of the issues that were raised was that the permanent injunction, did the court err on that side? We believe the court properly granted the permanent injunction. However, we believe the court should have granted the permanent injunction, not just based upon the factual issues that came out, that identify the fact that this was not a transaction that fell within the statute, that because it was commercially unreasonable and unfair, because it was almost one-third of fair market value of the property. Mm-hmm. There were stipulated facts on the record that these debtors, these borrowers and guarantors had the assets that could have paid this loan off in full, and that the letter they sent out under the statute that said we are looking to modify the loan was false. It was never intending to be a modification. It was intended to be a forced buyout of the loan, of the other beneficial interest, so that Desert Land Loan Acquisition would ultimately own it. So we stand firm on that aspect of it all, but we believe foundationally the judge still made an inappropriate determination about standing, that they can utilize the statute to begin with. It's still underlying the permanent injunction that was in.
So if we address that here, that makes the other moot.
Yes, correct. If the issue of statutory interpretation is as we stated it, that they do not have standing, because the result of the determination by the district court goes against the statutory purpose, and it also creates an absurd result. So if the court agrees with us with respect to that, that they don't have standing, everything else becomes moot. They no longer can utilize the statute.
Right, and I guess where I was just trying to understand is, it's essentially the same issues here and there.
They are.
And under lines of case law, they merge if there's a final judgment. And a permanent injunction is issued.
And they didn't. That's why the appeals got consolidated.
Should we have waited for the other case to have come up?
There were two consolidated appeals.
Correct.
One was a denial of the preliminary injunction. Then there was a subsequent order in March 1st, 2017, which was findings of fact, conclusions of law. That's here, too. Was that a permanent injunction?
Yes.
Or a preliminary injunction?
That was a permanent injunction. As to that issue, that became a permanent injunction.
So was it a final order? Because then what was the subsequent order that's on the subsequent appeal?
What happened in that scenario was there, after the Judge Gonzalez made that determination, procedurally, they moved to amend the complaint to move forward on another transaction. And through two different amended complaints, they continued to move forward additional transactions on the auspices of the statute. So we continued to litigate two different transactions, and those are the issues that finally led to a trial in March of 2018 that arguably merged everything together to a final judgment in the case, to which
now
there are other appeals.
The final judgment is the one that is directly appealable. The limits of an appeal from an order denying a preliminary injunction or from one granting one, if that preliminary injunction is merged into a final judgment, then the issues arise from the appeal of that final judgment. So I guess the question is, what's left of these two appeals that isn't embodied in the subsequent 7-6 and 7-7 series?
Well,
judgment.
The issue of statutory interpretation is still there and continues. What happened in the other two matters and the other two transactions, that one was deemed to be unfair and commercially unreasonable, and one that was ultimately approved, was the court allowed them to do so based upon the fact that the court continued to determine that they had standing.
Right, but that issue is alive in the appeal from the final judgment as well.
It is. It's something that we can deal with, and we did incorporate that into, we will. They took the appeal from the final judgment. We, from that perspective, cross-appealed on certain other issues with respect to other decisions that happened, including that issue. So technically, what you're asking, has everything that's going to be argued here today, could it be argued part of the next appeal? Absolutely.
Yeah, that was the question.
Absolutely, it can be.
So you're going to waive briefing in this other case?
No.
Oh, I see.
Well,
so how many times are we going to revisit the interpretation of the statute today, tomorrow, the next day? I mean, just because there are recurring clarifications or issues surrounding the interpretation of the statute, it follows itself through the case, follows itself through amended complaints. That doesn't afford you jurisdiction in this case. The question that Justice Perry-Gary is posing is, what is the basis for jurisdiction for us to hear this appeal today when it has been subsumed in a final judgment that is also on appeal? Could you answer that question?
The question with respect to that, and I think it applies to both of the consolidated appeals, is the issue, again, I apologize for repeating myself, is the issues with respect to underlying it all is that statutory interpretation. We filed the notice of appeal at the moment the court denied our preliminary injunction. They filed their notice of appeal at the moment the court granted the permanent injunction. Do those issues merge into later appeal? I'm going to sit here and say, yes, they do. Is this something that we could argue part of that subsequent appeal? Absolutely. Absolutely. But we could render any further appeals moot by virtue of both parties' belief of what the statutory interpretation is.
Did the permanent injunction resolve all claims in the case? Because if it's not a final judgment, is it appealable? I know it's not your appeal. I know they're appealing that decision.
We believe their appeal is moot for a completely different reason, for purpose of the fact that the court determined that there was actually a transaction that wasn't even under the statute. So they didn't have any standing at all because they tried to move forward on a transaction that didn't fall under 645B.340. But with respect to their standing, with respect to what they have, I think they followed procedurally any form of injunctive relief can be appealed. I don't want to argue for them, but that's what I think why they did so. And the court and Judge Gonzalez wouldn't, though she entered a permanent injunction, she would not really rule on any of the other remaining claims until the finality, the final trial, occurred in March of 2018. So all the other claims, other than a dismissal of our two of our contract claims, breach of contract and breach of guarantee, claiming that we did not have the 51%, we couldn't pursue those claims, which is again part of our appeal later. Everything continued with respect to what was happening. So it's hard for me to sit there. We file these appeals because the issue is the first impression. This issue about how the statute is going to apply, I mean, could render us coming back here in a few months on a subsequent appeal moot. So, to Justice Harris, to answer your question, could it be argued later? Yes. But we can, with respect to...
No, that's not the question.
Do we have basis to be here today?
Should we be hearing this case today because the court lacks jurisdiction or has jurisdiction? And I'm asking you a pretty straightforward question. What is the rule of civil procedure or the rule of appellate procedure that provides this court jurisdiction to hear this appeal? It seems like if there's some doubt about this, we go to all this effort to write an opinion or resolve this case and interpret this statute. It seems like that outcome is advisory.
It's not advisory. I think both sides have taken the position that a termination here could render anything that has happened since. We attempted to get.
I don't care what the parties stipulate to. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I'm talking about the effect of our jurisprudence. We decide actual controversies. What is the actual controversy in this case that hasn't been resolved in the subsequent case?
The issue with respect to the first transaction, with respect to the first denial of preliminary to permanent injunction, has it been merged into later? Sit here and say yes. When we filed the appeals, we had a basis, because it is subject matter jurisdiction, for an appeal upon a denial or a granting of an injunction. Once the preliminary injunction was denied, we had a basis to file that appeal. So we filed that appeal. We were unable to get a stay pending the appeal, so we had to continue with the case. So the issues with respect to that aspect of statutory interpretation was always there, and we were hoping to be able to come here many months ago, and if we were able to get a stay pending appeal, so we could make this argument. It is the primary issue in this case, because we could have both preserved a lot of assets, a lot of time and effort, if that determination, whether they have standing and can utilize the statute, or as other arguments we raised with respect to the statute, not just whether they have standing. Is there action of what they're doing to bring in a...
Would you agree with me that the appeals that we have in front of us today, they are not consolidated with the other two in which the opening brief is due on January 17th? There's no order consolidating.
No, they're not
these
consolidated.
These two orders appeals. With those two orders.
No.
And the brief, the opening brief, is due on January the 17th.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's going to be talking about an order that the judge entered that is characterized as the final order in the case.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I'm not going to say yes. And if I could just say one thing with respect to the statute, and one of the reasons we believe that it's an absurd result is because when you read the statutory and legislative history, you get to a point where you realize what they are trying to do, to allow a borrower and guarantors to create another entity to go out and buy interest to basically control their own loan, will turn the industry upside down. You're basically going to render the multi-beneficiary deed of trust type of loan lending, you're going to make it obsolete. Because basically, what is a borrower going to do? A borrower is then going to say, listen, I can control my own loan. So I'm going to go talk to a couple of these beneficiaries, gather the 51%. Then if you take what defendants are saying with respect to that, they can then write it off to zero because they have unfair discretion to do what they want. So in a really strange hypothetical, you could have a $10 million loan with 20 investors of $500,000 each. You can go, that borrower can go to 11 of them, $5.5 million, get 55%. Pay them $6 million. Actually, pay those two beneficiaries more. They have control of the loan, and then they say they can come under that statute and say, you know something, we don't have to pay anybody else anything else, zero.
But I guess what's bothersome, too, and there just wasn't much explanation as to why the statute applied. It's almost an implied concept that the statute applies without explaining why. She went right to the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and it wasn't fair. So I am...
What Judge Gonzalez stated was she wasn't going to read the word disinterested. There's nothing in the statute that says a borrower couldn't do that. We argued that it would create an absurd result in, with respect to the circumstances, but she said it's not for me to do that. It's for the legislature to make that determination.
Those issues that you just addressed are alive and well in the appeal that is being briefed this month, right?
It can be, yes.
Thank you.
It can be. So, respectfully, I know I didn't really reserve much time, Chief Justice. With respect to that, I think I kind of expected that. You know, in conclusion, this court raised two issues, whether desert land loan acquisition has the majority position. We say the answer to that is no. And the answer as to whether Judge Gonzalez erred with respect to granted a permanent injunction, no, she didn't err. She made a sound, reasonable decision. You can't, if a bar can create an entity and can utilize a statute, it has to be subject to court discretion as to whether it's a good faith, fair transaction. They can't control their loan, at the same point, do whatever they want. And that's what Judge Gonzalez determined. So when it comes to those two issues, we really do believe they do not have standing. They cannot utilize that. That's not the purpose of this statute. But if you believe they do, then you have to give the court discretion to make sure what they're doing is fair to all of the other beneficial interest holders who are not related to the borrower.
I do have one question. Is he out of time? Or?
30 seconds.
Oh, good. Okay. Justice Gibbons is a taskmaster, so one must be careful. You characterized your argument in the context of standing, but the judge made the decision on the basis of its abridgment of good faith and fair dealing. Those are two vastly different legal concepts, and I didn't see standing being the core of your argument. I thought it was a fairness argument throughout.
It is. What she determined.
So I just want to be sure I understand that in this case, we'll just focus on this case. You're not arguing standing in the true legal sense of the word standing, are you?
We are arguing.
I don't see that.
We are arguing it as to whether a borrower can create an entity to take advantage of what the statute states to take control of its own loan. And we believe the answer to that is no. So we believe the terminology be they don't have standing to take advantage of the statute. That they're not a party. That it wasn't intended for them to utilize the statute. The statute was intended for borrowers and investors to get together. A related entity to the borrower is not an investor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wall. I'm sure you know what the court's interested in, and you can jump into that particular issue.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you, Your Honors, for allowing us to be here today. I'm Michael Wall. I represent Desert Land Loan Acquisition and the Desert Land LLC and the other cross-appellants, who I believe are the only true appellants in this matter at this point in this appeal. To address the jurisdictional issue, there has never been a permanent injunction issued by the district court. There was instead a motion for a preliminary injunction that was denied. Then there was an appeal from that. Then there was a preliminary injunction that was granted. The same motion for preliminary injunction on reconsideration, preliminary injunction granted with extended findings of fact and conclusions of law. That preliminary injunction enjoined Desert Land, or particularly DLLA, from going forward with a proposal that they had already made, not only already had made, but had already been accepted by a majority by vote. She enjoined the going forward with that as a part of the action that was brought, which was a declaratory relief action by the appellants, Cher and their group, to preclude Desert Land from doing anything with respect to the project and with respect to changing the loan documents and those things, for the very reason that we heard from opposing counsel here today, because they believe that the majority can't be interested. That's the sole issue.
So, first of all, let me get this straight. So you're saying Judge Gonzalez didn't consolidate the second injunction here on the merits as a final injunction? It was always designed to be a preliminary injunction. Was it ever bonded, the preliminary injunction?
There never was a bond involved with
it. Wasn't it void on its face?
Or a finding of likelihood of success?
Yeah.
There were
irreparable injury?
There were all of those things with the preliminary injunction and findings of fact and conclusions of law. The jurisdictional basis for this appeal is that it was a preliminary injunction. It has not been rendered moot, the injunction itself, because the proceedings that followed did not result in a judgment that addresses the same issues that this case addresses. The representation that Desert Land, or DLLA then amended their complaint a couple of times and we had additional proceedings in the district court is incorrect. That never happened. There's only the complaint that came from Cher, the cross claims from the defendants, and there were no amendments. What happened was, after the district court rejected the first proposal, which is the proposal that we still believe, which is still enjoined by the preliminary injunction in which we believe we should be able to implement. After she rejected the first proposal, Desert Land came back with under the same theory of being able to amend the thing, they were trying to find a proposal that the judge might accept, and so they gave a new proposal. She rejected that. They had some more proceedings, another trial, and Desert Land proposed a third proposal, and the judge accepted that, and that became a final judgment, not an injunction against anybody, and this preliminary injunction does not merge into that final judgment.
Why not?
Because that final judgment deals with a proposal, a third proposal, that Desert Land was compelled by the court to bring because of the first preliminary injunction order. If this court determines that Judge Gonzalez was wrong with respect to that first preliminary injunction order, the appropriate ruling should be a remand to instruct Judge Gonzalez that she has to reinstate the first proposal. What we're briefing in the briefs from the final judgment is the judge's order with respect to the third proposal. In fact, the only reason that Desert Land, because they prevailed on basically
everything. But you have to undo the third proposal and the judgment enforcing it in order to wind this back to the first proposal. I mean, I don't see how you get there except for on the direct appeal from the final judgment.
I understand the concern that the argument can be made in the final judgment, in the appeal from the final judgment, that we should get to go backwards to the other step. But the problem that we have is different findings of fact, different conclusions of law, and a determination there, the reason the Desert Land appealed, that although we prevailed on all of the issues, which he's calling standing, but they're not standing issues, they're issues of whether or not the statute applies. The judge found in favor of Desert Land in its findings of fact on every one of those issues. What it didn't find in favor of Desert Land was that it didn't like the proposal. It thought the proposal was unfair. And so the judge did a general fairness analysis. And so exactly what the statute was intended to preclude, that the minority would be able to hold up projects for years and years and years, is exactly what has happened here, because that's what the district judge did. The reason it's not moot, going back to the first one, is because the second and the third proposals were compelled, and they changed the circumstances of the case dramatically and the record.
But if there's a final judgment, did the preliminary injunction become a permanent injunction at the end of the case then?
It did not.
Did it cease to exist? Because you can't have a preliminary injunction in place after a final judgment's entered.
That's the problem, because that's why this case is so different from most cases. Because it was a preliminary injunction, and that injunction is you cannot go forward with proposal number one. And unfortunately, the judgment is you can go forward with proposal number three. We want to go forward. I mean, we have to. In the other appeal, we're in the position of defending both.
But to bring it back to its simplest element, all of them have the aspect that the statute applies. Whether she made findings specific to why it applies, it's implicit in the determinations that the statute applies, right?
That's correct.
Isn't that the only thing that's really relevant here? And that, to me, would seem to be...
No, because there's one more step. After we decide whether or not the statute applies, we have to decide how to apply it to the three different proposals and why there are different proposals in the other appeal than
that. That goes back to her findings with regard to the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is a separate issue.
That's correct. But if this court is to determines that this preliminary injunction was improperly granted because the judge correctly construed the statute, because all of those findings of fact and conclusions of law in favor of Desert Land should be accepted by this court unless they're clearly erroneous as a matter of law. We believe if you read the statute, you will find that that's exactly what the statute intended, what the judge found. Then we get to the point where she abused her discretion. What she did is a general fairness analysis of the case, and she kept that general fairness analysis going for years, which undermines the statute entirely. The whole purpose of the statute has been defeated if a minority of one who has a judicial robe on can overrule and supplant the majority. The standard that we approach, the only argument that we raise is that the judge applied the wrong standard. The covenant of good faith and fair dealings is a completely different thing than just a general fairness analysis. We went through in our brief all of the elements of a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The first one of those, the most important, is you have to have bad faith. It's not just a matter of whether the judge thinks that it's commercially reasonable. The majority gets to decide that. If you go through the good faith analysis, Desert Land acted in complete good faith. The first thing to recognize is that...
So if the court were to decide in this case that a good faith overlay exists on the statute, which seems to be the most generous characterization of the district court's ruling, which of the two appeals would apply? This one or the one that's pending?
If this court decides that the judge should not have done a general fairness analysis...
I didn't say that. It was the opposite. If this court recognizes that the statute is subject to a fairness analysis, which appeal applies?
If this court recognizes that there's a general fairness analysis and that the judge did that, then it will be necessary to address the other appeals. If this court were to make the opposite conclusion,
why would that be the case? Why would that be the case?
That would be the case because in the other ones, the judge eventually reached the conclusion that the third proposal that from Desert Land was good, and we haven't appealed from that part of the decision.
I guess we're very fortunate that there were 10 proposals or 15. Because that suggests that there would have been 10 or 15 more appeals up here.
Well,
I go back to the question, Mr. Wall, that was proposed to your colleague. What's the rule that gives this court jurisdiction in this case to hear this so-called preliminary injunction?
And
when the court has entered, I don't know what it's entered, he's characterized it as a final judgment. I don't know how you characterize it. Is it not a final judgment?
There is a final judgment now.
That's what it says.
From which they have appealed, and we have appealed from portions of that as well. But that final judgment...
So why isn't this order in this case interlocutory? It sounds like the judge was engaged in a process of having the parties go back, come back, go back, come back with different proposals in order to fit within the judge's view of what would be fair or not fair. And each of those reactions, why shouldn't this court characterize each of those reactions as interlocutory in nature?
We are mixing up concepts of jurisdiction and justiciability, which are different concepts here.
Let's stick with
all appeals. from preliminary injunctions, by nature, are interlocutory. The fact that it's interlocutory does not affect the jurisdiction of this court. If you bring an interlocutory appeal and subsequent action makes that appeal moot, then the case law of this court says that that question is no longer justiciable because it has been rendered moot by what has happened. My argument is that the arguments that go to the application of the first proposal are not rendered moot. And in the other appeal, we don't have an adequate forum to address that issue because the judge has already decided in our favor, but on the wrong proposal, which puts us in the position of having to argue both that she's right and that she's wrong.
But
in
you
the same
would
appeal.
Be just like anybody else from an appeal from a final judgment, seeking to enlarge. I mean, you would have a cross appeal and you would seek to enlarge your position by saying, court, you should go back to the first one. It was in error when she did it. My problem is that the final judgment resolves this dispute between the parties finally. It's over.
Yes.
And then it comes up and all the issues in play come up from that final judgment. And so the first proposal that was enjoined, isn't that injunction superseded? Not, it doesn't kill it, but it superseded the relief that was granted in the final judgment is inconsistent with the injunction in the first, on the first proposal, correct?
In most cases, that is that's absolutely true, and that's why the final judgment subsumes the other one and the issues become moot.
Was your point that if we were to rule that this appeal was mooted by the final judgment, would you then say you could not re-raise the issues you're arguing here in the current
appeal? Not as effectively
appeal?
As I can raise it now.
That's not my question. Can you raise the same issues in the direct appeal that you're seeking to raise here?
I'm not sure that I can because I have a final judgment later on that is based on circumstances that are completely different in which I then am in the position of arguing both things. The point is the preliminary
what would we do with the final judgment were we to credit the position of either side on this appeal?
If this court upholds the judge's determination on the final judgment of the construction of the statute she has given it, Desert Land wins, but they have proposal number 3. Desert Land should win on that same analysis with respect to proposal number 1, and they shouldn't be in the position of having to come here and argue both proposal number 1 and proposal number 3.
Why not?
In the same brief. Well,
I mean, people bring claims for contract damages and tort damages. They go to trial, they get contract but not tort. They're unhappy, but they nonetheless won. So they say on cross appeal, we didn't get as much money as we wanted, even though we were partially victorious. Why are you any different?
Because the underlying facts basing that the determination of the damages are based upon are the same in both of theirs, and they're not in mine. In my case, the underlying facts have been fundamentally changed, and the issue hasn't been rendered moot. So there's jurisdiction for an interlocutory appeal. And the question, the only question that's presented, which is whether or not that first proposal should be enforced, has not been rendered moot. This court has a justiciable issue in front of it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Federer, I think you did use up your time. We'll try and sort this out the best we can. We appreciate the excellent arguments and briefs. Fine attorneys on both sides, and you've served your clients well, and we appreciate that. So we will take the case under submission at this time.